So first of all, the person that you should blame for the content of this talk is Senthil. I have chosen this topic because my esteemed colleague used some of the considerable force of his personality to prevail upon me to give a sort of service talk. And he gave a good argument for this, which is that one way in which an interdisciplinary workshop like this can be successful is if people from their respective participating disciplines share with people from the other community their deep and abiding facts, the sort of important background information that they take for granted when approaching a physics problem. And the example of such a deep and abiding fact that string theorists and people who think about quantum gravity like that Senthil and I agreed upon is black hole thermodynamics, and in particular the ideas surrounding the black hole information problem. And so part of my goal is to give some hopefully concise discussion of these ideas, which will hopefully be comprehensible to many people. And in particular, I want to explain how we should, why we think we should think of black holes as thermodynamic objects, and how this leads to certain apparent paradoxes whose resolution represents some progress towards understanding what quantum gravity is or should be. And then there's a second goal, which is to describe some, which seems like a left turn, which is to describe some attempts to use the machinery of holography to say something about systems with Fermi surfaces which don't have long-lived quasi-particles. So this seems like a complete left turn, but then I want to explain that the same issues that lead to the black hole information problem also bedevil these attempts to use holography to describe non-Fermi liquids. And really, it's really the same problem. And so this will give me some opportunity to redress certain grievances regarding the apparent ground state entropy of the Rising Direction black hole and de Sitter space. And I guess the more positive way to say that is it's an opportunity to frame the discussion of holographic states of matter at finite density. So it's an example that we can use to begin the discussion. Though I guess the discussion has been going on for quite a while. Okay, so that's the plan. All right, so we'll see how it goes. So I'm not going to start from all the way at the beginning, but let's start with some laws of equilibrium, black hole mechanics. So I'm going to give some. I said the word concise. So I'll try to do that. I guess I should start by saying what a black hole is. Let's say a black hole is a region of no escape. That's my definition. I guess a more maybe a more useful way to think about it is to give an example. Let's think about a static, non-rotating black hole in some space-time which I won't specify. Let's just say it's something like this. So I'm going to write a metric which has some form like this. There's a time coordinate. There's a radial coordinate. This coordinate is the direction you go in to get away from the black hole. And then there's some directions along the black hole. And let's say the whole metric that I'm writing is d plus one dimensional. So this thing is, let's say this thing is a d minus one dimensional round sphere. So near, far away from the black hole, I'll call r goes to infinity, there's some sort of asymptopium. This is a fancy word. Which means far away. And which may be maybe it's flat space. Maybe it's the boundary that the center space. I'll be agnostic about that for now. Later we'll be more specific. But then let's assume that there's some place which I'll call r sub h, which is a horizon. And I'm not going to give a fancy definition of horizon. Let's just say it's a place where this f, which is universally called by everyone the emblackening factor, it means that it has a linear zero. It's a perfectly Kronian word. It has a linear zero near r equals rh, and this kappa is some number. which will come up again much more later, and then there's some expansion around articles of H. And so, more generally, you could imagine situations, you could imagine special situations where this thing vanishes, and this is a second order zero, and that's going to come up later. A horizon with this property, let's call a, actually a little more specific, this is called a Rindler horizon, where this kappa, which is called the surface gravity, is non-zero. And so near this horizon, near R equals RH, let's focus on the region near there, this metric, let's expand it around that point, and we can choose coordinates which are more useful there. Let me replace this radial coordinate. Instead of measuring the displacement from the horizon in R, let me just introduce another coordinate rho, and you'll see why in a second. So the metric near the horizon takes this approximate form. The sphere has approximately some constant radius, because there's some linear term here. There's a constant term here. And rho is defined by this equation, basically. I've defined rho so that this proper length, the proper distance away from the horizon. It's this form. The reason to do this is because it lets you see that if we for some reason were possessed to consider, instead of real time, so this t is like a real time coordinate which goes into the future, if we instead happen to consider some Euclidean time related to it by a factor of I, then this metric would equal plus, so that the point of the I is to put a plus there, kappa rho squared, tau squared, plus the rho squared, plus the rest of the stuff. And this thing you recognize, if you squint a little bit, as, it looks just like flat states in polar coordinates, right? Two-dimensional flat states in polar coordinates. And with the minor catch that if we don't pick the periodicity of tau correctly, so it'll look like a cone. So if I drew the picture of this direction is rho, this direction is tau. And you see, unless tau is identified with tau plus 2 pi over kappa, there's a singularity. Alternatively, if we identify tau with tau plus 2 pi over kappa, the Euclidean geometry is regular. And the reason that this is a good idea to do is because if it's not, then there's a singularity here. There's a curvature singularity. And this metric doesn't solve the vacuum Einstein's equations, which for the purposes that we'll care about matters. And so only if we make this identification of the Euclidean time by this certain period is this regular. And so it's natural to identify that thing with some kind of inverse temperature. And since Euclidean periodic Euclidean time means finite temperature. OK, so that was that's the setup. And now I can introduce the 6 or something laws of equilibrium black hole thermodynamics that I'm going to talk about, starting with the famous minus second law, which also is sometimes called the no-Herrick theorem. These are the negative laws are sort of prerequisites for having laws of thermodynamics. So this is the statement that we can label stationary black holes. Stationary is related to equilibrium black holes by a few parameters. Which let me just go ahead and call them state variables, which have names like the mass and the charge, and maybe there's a magnetic charge, and maybe there's an angular momentum. And then maybe if we're really fancy, there's some kind of order parameters or some spontaneous symmetry breaking of some global symmetries. And then maybe there's some topological order also. I'm trying to make a comparison between labeling state macrostates of black holes and labeling states of matter, and something we famously learned from condensed matter physics in the last, 30 years, is that you can't always do this using local order parameters. And so I think we do know an analog of this, which is I'm a little bit ashamed to say this, but I think black rings are kind of an example of this. where the topology of the horizon is another label on the state that you can't, that isn't a local label. So anyway, somebody could argue with me about this later. this is a joke, maybe.
Those also have dipole charges.
Dipole moments, yeah.
You might use that as a like.
Maybe. But, okay, yeah, that might be true.
No, how about if I just look at if entropy has some subleading term which is some universal number?
Yeah, that's probably a more correct thing to do. But I don't know if we know any. I don't think we know an example where we know that. I think this is an interesting thing to think about, provoked by this analogy. Okay, so then that's the minus second law. The minus first law is that, I guess it's...
Wait, so what this is presumably saying, you can't label it by some other things. What are...
You don't need to label it by other things. Right.
There's no other features.
Right, that's right. They're featureless.
Yeah, so what other things are we ruling out with this?
Well, like you could imagine that there's like a black hole solution with like a tree coming out of it. That you don't. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
So this is a statement just about classical gravity.
Classical gravity, that's right. Yeah, so maybe that also probably does is the suggestion.
How the statement follows from your discussion of the metric?
Oh, you want me to prove it to you?
No. I just want to know what the relationship is between. So that's just an assertion that the...
It's an assertion.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Which can be proved under various circumstances.
Fine.
I'll say a little more about why the other things are true. And I think if we include things like this, it's even true in ADS.
The question was how do you prove this? I mean, this is not a theorem, except without specifying your matter fields. Right. So for every choice of matter that you couple to gravity, you can ask what black hole solutions exist. And so then you get a family of uniqueness theorems. You couple gravity to sort of linear, minimally coupled scalars, then you find that the black holes are only characterized by these considered quantities.
We know there's unbelievable gauge here.
Yes. So Einstein Yang Mills, for example, has other black holes than these simple ones. You can have gauge.
Oh, that's a much better example. Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. So I've got to get up to three here. So let's. So the minus first law, I'd like to say, is the statement that deviations from these equilibrium states go away. So that it's useful to think of it as an equilibrium state to which is approached at late times. Let's say excitations above the stationary state evolve away.
Are you saying that the black holes are stable?
Yes, I guess that's maybe more concise.
That's not true.
Let me come back here. All right, now we're okay?
I mean, if the black hole is stationary, even in Einstein gravity, it's not true. I mean, rotating black holes in six or above dimensions are all unstable.
They're unstable.
Black rings are unstable. Yeah.
Okay, so.
Phases of matter can be unstable too.
Right? Yeah.
So I guess maybe. Okay, here we go. Excitations above the correct stationary state.
And this means small amplitude.
Yeah, and but there are also theorems about large amplitude things.
Crash another one
into it or something. Oh, okay, good. but there's still a statement, right, which is that the two of them that you crash into each other will then form a bigger one, right, which will be in this set of things. Good. Okay, so now finally we got to one that actually other people have called by this name, and the zeroth law is just a statement that this kappa, this thing that I wrote here, the surface gravity, is a constant on the event horizon. So here, from the point of view of this example I've written, this is a totally trivial statement because I sort of define kappa to be a constant. But for more interesting rotating or otherwise not this black hole. This is an untrivial statement which can be proved using Einstein's equations and some assumptions about the field content.
No, but whole couple will be defined more generally.
Yeah, there's some fancy covariant formula for it, which I'm going to get wrong. Something like some derivative, there's a metric, and there's some covariant derivative, and there's a normal vector. No,
there's too many for work out on this. Now, what is this thing that's supposed to be a constant beyond this?
It's the temperature.
It's the temperature, yeah. Okay.
What's the resistance of Okay. So I'm appealing, of course, to everyone's familiarity with the usual laws of thermodynamics to make the parallels. But if I don't make it explicit enough, please ask. Yeah, so this is the temperature. As you can see from here, there's kappa constant, kappa potential. Okay, the first law is, I guess, sometimes called the Smars formula. It is the statement like this, that if I make some small change in the mass, that's in staying equilibrium, then that's related to changes in these other state variables by a formula like this, involving products of potentials and changes in extensive variables. G and a little zeta here. And then maybe there's a PDV. This isn't there for black holes, but it is there for black brains. And so let me define the symbols of it here. So this is something like an angular velocity. This is an angular momentum, which is extensive. This is some electrostatic potential. This is some charge, which is extensive. This kappa is what I've defined here. This thing is meant to be a zeta, which actually drops out of the formula, but I've left here because it's an ambiguity in how to split this thing into an intensive part and the variation of an extensive part. And this thing is there for black brains, which are black holes where the horizon, rather than just being some compact thing, is extended over some Euclidean translation invariant thing. Okay, and so the idea for why this is true is also pretty simple. Let's think about the case where there's no angular velocity and no electrostatic potential, then the only thing, and let's also consider this case where there's no notion of pressure, then we just need to think about this term, which I should say is like the TDS term. Then the left-hand side of this equation, the change in the mass of the black hole, well, the way this comes about, we can account for how this comes about by integrating over the horizon in order for the black hole to grow, to fall into it, integrating over the horizon the flux of the energy current. And then nobody will complain if I write the energy current as something like the stress tensor with the time component and the mu integrated against some kind of area element. That's a T and that's a mu. That index is contracted with this normal vector to the surface. And then we can use Einstein's equations to write this in terms of the curvature. So I guess maybe I've assumed that we're in vacuum to say that Einstein's equation is just... I just want to give you the idea. The stress tensor in the bulk is related to the curvature. And then this thing here is just some geometric property of the horizon. And so then you can easily imagine that this curvature is related to that formula that I failed to write down for the surface gravity. And so you can imagine that this thing gets related to this kappa times. Okay. So that's the idea. So that's one, and now we can go to two. So the second law. I'm going to have a question for Gary about this one. The second law is Hawking's area theorem, which can be stated quite concisely as the area of the event horizon doesn't decrease under time evolution. So this thing that appears here is positive if we evolve forward in time under classical evolution. And the assumptions that I understand about that I've read about this are that this assumes, first of all, cosmic an assumption called cosmic censorship, which is a conjectured statement based on both a lot of anecdotal evidence and optimism that the equations of motion of general relativity will not lead to their own demise outside of event horizons. So that all of the places where the equations break down because the curvature becomes large will be hidden by some kind of event horizon.
Don't we have lots of examples where you think that's not true anymore?
Yeah, but the like string syntopic loop that creates naked singularity.
Yeah, so this is so good. So actually, this brings me to my question for Gary, which is I think we know that this is there's no reason to doubt this that this is true in asymptotically flat 3+1-dimensional space, and I think also it's only in the asymptotically flat space that I've actually seen a proof of this statement. So is there a proof of this statement?
That means far away from any of
these. Right. That this asymptopium is just true. So what I mean by flat is that as r goes to infinity, this approaches minus the t squared plus the r squared. So just flat space.
You don't mean flat. It's certainly true for asymptotically ADF.
It is. Okay.
And it's also, so cosmic censorship, you're right, is needed in one version of the result, but you can also prove it under a different assumption, which is that the null generators of the horizon are complete. So if
but doesn't that, I thought that's the thing you prove and then assume cosmic censorship.
No. Cosmic censorship has to do with singularities outside the horizon.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So if you simply know that the horizon itself is complete, the null GV6 on the horizon can be extended arbitrarily far into the future, uh-huh. You don't care whether there's any singularities outside the horizon. There can be lots of naked singularities outside the horizon, and you could still get the result like this.
I see. But isn't, the statement that those null generators of the horizon are complete is sort of, isn't that more or less a lot of the way towards cosmic censorship?
No.
Because, how do you form a singularity by something collapsing?
Yeah, but there could be no horizon at all.
Right, sure, it could be somewhere else, I agree.
You could have naked singularities with no horizons in sight.
So naked singularities are in places of space that you can actually get to.
Well, that you can see. The idea of a naked singularity is a singularity that you can see, that light can, in principle, travel arbitrarily close to the singularity out to distant observers.
Okay, good. And the other assumption we made, I think, is probably also present with this other.
So the idea that this area is only decreasing implies flatness?
No. I was inquiring about under what circumstances the statement had been proven.
Yeah.
So the proof that I know about did assume that the black hole was living in flat space, so that far away from the black hole, the space looked like this.
It is for simplicity that you...
It's because of my incomplete knowledge of the literature. So that's why I was asking this question. But I think an assumption which is probably also true in those other circumstances is that it requires the null energy condition. Which is the statement that... it's an assumption about the matter content that the stress energy of the matter satisfies this property that if you contract it with any null vector k, then it's positive. So this is basically the statement that you can't make time machines. If you violate this condition, you can use the matter to construct something like a time machine. So that's good. So now we get to the one that'll come up the most later, which is the third law. And the statement of it that I'll use is that kappa, this thing is playing the role of the temperature, can't be taken to zero in a finite number of steps. So I guess this is called the Clausius formulation of the third law. And we should contrast this with what I think is called the Planck formulation. Which is the statement that the entropy as t goes to zero And the reason that it's not this version is because we know very explicitly counterexamples to this statement, namely black holes. The black hole where this is not true, where the zero temperature. Sorry, I guess I should have said. So the version of it with the area of the horizon, that's the thing that's playing the role of the entropy. Yeah. We know black holes are the area of the horizon as t goes to zero. Is not zero.
So we don't know cases where you reach extremality in finite time.
That's right. I think that's true. Yeah. And the idea for why that's the case, I don't really know how to prove this, but the idea for why you can't reach extremality in finite time is let's imagine trying to do it. Right. So suppose we have. So I guess I should say before I say that. Black holes with this property are called extremal, because in general,
black holes with zero area,
non-zero area at zero temperature, with this property, because in general, the absence of naked singularities requires the mass of the black hole to be larger than its charge. And extremal black holes saturate this inequality. And so consider the following process. Suppose you start with a non-extremal black hole, so one where this is inequality is not saturated, and try to make it extremal by throwing charge in. You have some collection of charges. Each of them has some mass, and you want to cause this thing to become an extremal black hole by increasing its mass and its charge in such a way that m plus m equals b plus q. But then in the process of doing that, these charges have to overcome the electrostatic repulsion, right? From the black hole is charged, the charge is charged, there's an electrostatic repulsion, there's a gravitational attraction. And by some manipulations, you can convince yourself that either you have to force the charges in there by some external force, which will add energy to the black hole, or you have to do it by infinitesimal steps, arbitrarily small steps, which means that it takes forever. So this is the idea for why this is the case.
We could wait for it to radiate down externally.
Well, we're not there yet.
Okay.
Yeah. So we're still laboring under this carrot. Okay. Just like in ordinary thermodynamics, the content of this, the third law, is that you can't have zero temperature entropy because if you did, an arbitrarily small perturbation would disturb it and would split this degeneracy.
Sorry, so extremal black holes, they have mass bigger than...
No, extremal, sorry. That's the case that this inequality is saturated.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's why it's extreme.
But the non-extremal, generic black hole will satisfy the inequality.
Yes, that's right. Okay, so combining this collection of information with the fact that there should also be ordinary stuff coupled to this gravitational system, we're led to introduce what's called the generalized second law. Or I guess rather Bekenstein was. Which is the statement that the total entropy, which accounts for both the entropy of all the black holes, sorry, which accounts for both the entropy of the ordinary stuff, so just the ordinary thermodynamic entropy of all the stuff that's in the world, plus this constant zeta here, which we haven't yet determined, times the areas of all the black holes, so I labels all the black holes over g Newton, is not decreasing. In physical processes. Okay, so the idea being just if you didn't account for the black hole entropies in your accounting for thermodynamics, then you can make arbitrarily efficient engines by just throwing all your waste heat into the black holes and forgetting about it. So if you want to have consistent thermodynamics, you better include this term there. Okay, so but this immediately leads us to a problem. Which is that we've assigned black holes an entropy here, But black holes are black, and so if you imagine putting it in contact with some kind of heat bath, then there's no way to maintain equilibrium, right? Because the radiation goes in, but it doesn't come out. And so, they're not black bodies, apparently. And the resolution of this is in this little constant here, which is that, and I guess this is really the important part of the important insight of Hawking, is that this constant actually has one over h bar in it. And so that means that the entropy of the black hole is proportional to the area over times 1 over h bar, and the temperature of the black hole is proportional to h bar. Right, so we've, this zeta here, this is 1 over h bar, this is h bar, that means classically the temperature goes to 0. And I guess the more useful statement is, including quantum mechanics, a black hole does radiate like a black body with temperature the one that you think. Kappa over 2 pi, there's an h bar. Did I get it right? Yeah, okay. And so you see this immediately fixes this zeta to be not just proportional to 1 over h bar, but rather to equal 1 over 4 h bar. And so it fixes the entropy. It's a 4 there.
I guess what's interesting, even though the temperature goes to 0 at h bar, all this stuff is visible classically, right? So, I mean, that's sort of the miracle of it, right?
Well, the stuff that doesn't have an h bar in the numerator is visible classically.
Okay, cancel. I mean, so for example,
right, so here they cancel. Bar, that's right. Right. Yeah. Right, good. The solution to this problem creates another problem, which is that if the black hole is in flat space, this radiation can escape. And so the black hole evaporates. And so indeed, this you could imagine making an extremal black hole in flat space this way. In the interest of time, maybe I won't give the derivation of this statement. But if you want to narrow the derivation, ask Senthil, because he's already learned this and used it to good effect. all right. So let me give a brief statement of the black hole information problem. Which is immediately raised, one version of this information problem, which is immediately raised by this observation. And so to do this, I'm going to draw some cartoons. One version of the information problem. I'm going to draw a cartoon of a classical black hole. This kind of cartoon is called a Penrose diagram. And so here's a picture. The only thing I'm going to tell you about, so this is a picture of a black hole in flat space. The only thing I'm going to tell you about the picture is that, so space is the region inside here. The thing it encodes is that light moves on 45 degree lines. And this region here, this thing here, and this thing here is what I mean by this asymptopium, this line here. And this thing is the event horizon. And the stuff behind here is the singularity. There's this line is the singularity. Okay, and so a picture of a black hole formed from some collapsing stuff. And so this is, so a picture of a black hole formed from collapsing stuff is something like this. Like imagine we send in, so this is just a picture of Minkowski space, part of Minkowski space. So we send in some shell of radiation. It collapses and forms a black hole. So another picture we could have drawn is something like this. Where the fact that this is moving on a 45 degree line means that it's moving at the speed of light, that's why I say it's radiation. In contrast, you could have imagined forming the black hole by some shell of ordinary matter, which moves not at 45 degrees, but the end result is the same. So this is radiation. So this is a picture of a classical black hole formed by gravitational collapse of some stuff. Okay, And so the issue about information arises because we think that we should be able to time evolve some stuff at early time, which is like along this line or maybe along some space-like thing like this, some stuff at early times, to the end of the world without losing any data. right? That there should be some unitary map evolving by some, you know, the Hamiltonian of the world from here to somewhere like here, which really is unitary and doesn't lose any information. And so in this picture, that's not really a problem. But we get into trouble if we try to account for the fact that the black hole evaporates. So this is a classical black hole. And I guess, so this picture actually is well defined. The picture I'm about to draw is not, and this is more of a cartoon than even an ordinary Penrose diagram. So we should draw something like the same picture. Here's the radiation that comes in, the event horizon forms, here's this, there's some singularity here, but then the black hole evaporates, and there's this Minkowski space left over. Right, so this is a bit of a cartoon. But you see, so here at the end of the world, there's still this Minkowski phase with no black hole in here, because the black hole is evaporating. Okay, so now consider the following three constant time slices. So here's one time slice. Let's call it sigma 1. This is a surface of constant time. It looks funny because we did this Penrose trick. But this is some, you know, we could imagine some set of observers that think of the points on this pink line as being a constant time. That's some, you know, their watches all say the same thing. So that's one, and let's say three is something like this. And then two is something carefully chosen so that part of it is outside the black hole, and then part of it is inside. Okay, so that's two. It's carefully chosen to make the problem, you know, maximally confusing. And then just consider the following thing. We expect a wave function, so pick some final state on sigma 3. We expect you to be able to get this by some unitary map, time evolved from this initial state, from some initial state on sigma 1. But on the other hand, let's assume that sigma 2 is some union of some part inside the black hole and some part outside the black hole. And so here's the crucial if the Hilbert space of theory living on sigma 2 is a tensor product of the stuff inside and the stuff outside, well, then you can imagine we can evolve, we can get this guy here from just the stuff outside, right? Because this stuff goes into the singularity, no one ever hears from it again, from some unitary map from 3 to 2, that just involves the out stuff, but on the other hand, the stuff on sigma 2 all knows about the stuff from sigma 1, and so the information over here is just gone. Okay, so this is the problem, and so there are many possible ways to try to resolve this. There are huge struggles which I will now skip, and the resolution of the problem seems to be something that is called black hole complementarity. Complementarity, after this Bohr kind of word, which is, I mean, I guess it's kind of a cheap version of it, is that just that this isn't true. That's the basic lesson. And the reason that this is possible is the fact that nobody can argue with the statement. There's no one observer that can contradict this statement. So there's two kinds of observers, which have these silly names. One of them is a bunch of people that sit outside and use the asymptotic time coordinate. So that's someone who looks like this. There's world line, or maybe it starts here. They're all the same color. Okay. Maybe it starts here, but he, you know, lives his whole life outside the black hole using this asymptotic time coordinate. This guy is a, I don't even know how to say his word. FIFO, yeah? Okay, let's say FIFO. And, you know, someone who uses the asymptotic time coordinate sees the horizon as a real thing, right? It's the place where time stops. And, you know, so one of these guys looking at the black hole sees, like, all the stuff that falls in accumulating near the horizon into some hot soup, some kind of membrane that lives on the horizon. he can assign an entropy, which, you know, because the stuff accretes on the horizon is related to the area. And so the horizon matters. So this is one perspective, and the other perspective is one of an observer who instead does something like this, who starts out here and then just, you know, jumps in and doesn't fight the gravitational pull of the black hole. And to someone like this, just freely falling into the black hole, the horizon just doesn't matter at all. There's nothing happens at the horizon. Okay, and so these two perspectives are, you know, seemingly totally contradictory, but you can convince yourself that nobody can actually disagree. It's just not possible for them to communicate to each other. So this, you know, this person doesn't see anything happen. The what is the word? Fido doesn't see anything happen at the horizon, but doesn't have enough time to communicate with the FIFO before he's pulped into little mush by the singularity. And so this argument makes this possible, this really weird conclusion that the Hilbert space is not made up of local degrees of freedom inside the horizon, outside the horizon. It makes this possible, right? It makes it not inconsistent, but it doesn't really say what the right accounting of degrees of freedom are, is. And for that, we need a much more extreme version of complementarity, which is called the holographic principle.
Just one, please. Just to make sure one understands. So the statement is that there's not enough time for them to.
Yeah.
Before this guy falls in, he can't.
So you can imagine some kind of experiment where, you know, this person carries some information and jumps into the black hole and, like, you know, tries to send a photon out to this person, like, right before it falls in to, like, copy the information of the data. And you can convince yourself that in order for that data to reach this other person in enough time, it has to be very energetic. And it has to be a very high frequency photon. And in fact, so big that it makes the black hole bigger. And so he would have to have been eaten before he sent it. So there's a long series of such thought experiments by Susskind and Uglum and Thorlacius and people like this from the early 90s, which more or less, I think, account for every such possible way of violating the incommunicability of these two perspectives. I should have said, by the way, you know, I'm not giving references here. I think this is a good opportunity for me to put some references on the wiki. If I don't do it, please remind me. Did I answer your question?
No.
Okay, I tried.
And so, John, in your opinion, it's still true, even if you accept complementarity, that we really have very little idea how the information gets out?
Well, no, I mean, so in some examples, you know, I mean, so this, you know, this doesn't say where the information is, right? But, and so to do better, we need some statement like the following, which is that the case of the quantum gravity theory is actually that of some lower dimensional field theory.
Right.
And if you have a sharp enough accounting of this information, then yeah. So Shaman is alluding to the following sort of lame, but nevertheless very true and important statement, which is that this problem of black hole information is in principle completely solved by at least for the case of anti de Sitter black holes, by ADS-CFT. By the fact that in certain cases, and so in particular in the case of gravity in asymptotically anti de Sitter space, we have a definition of the quantum gravity theory in terms of some ordinary field theory, which manifestly has a unitary time evolution. In which case this equation, if you like, is a definition going that way, which circumvents the problem. Right? It's manifestly true that you can describe this whole process in terms of the dynamics of the quantum field theory, but I think there is definitely still a question of some microscopic bookkeeping of what the information is.
Yeah.
Charles?
Yeah.
Do you have any thoughts about some of the work that Samir has been, Samir Mathur has been?
I do, but I don't think I can say anything useful about it right now.
So I unfortunately missed some of the discussion, but at the Aspen workshop, apparently he, and maybe there's a paper out now where he's apparently refined some of the arguments in favor of there actually being an information paradox, information loss after all.
Yeah, he attempted to explain to a room full of string theorists at Aspen why they were all wrong about
climate change. How
did that go?
Yeah, but he didn't back down. He's just trying to, he wasn't saying information is lost, but just that he can construct an argument that says under a certain set of assumptions it would be, and one of those assumptions, all of which sound quite reasonable, must be wrong. But any of those assumptions being wrong is shocking.
But one of them was something like this, right?
Oh, okay.
Was one of them?
Yeah, exactly. But the question is to what degree that's false.
Right. Yeah. This is still an open question.
There's still a degree question. How non-local should the degree be?
That's right. So that's why I write the word extreme here. Right. So this is like the most extreme possible thing. So not only is this stuff not independent from this stuff, but like you don't need to keep track of any of the local information in this direction. Right? The whole thing just gets smushed down into the Hilbert space of a lower dimensional field theory. So this is a really very extreme version, which we have every reason to believe is true for the special case of gravity and asymptotically entered the center space, but in general, we don't know. This is a good question which you guys should answer.
So the holographic principle is conjectured for any spacetime. And that was my impression from the logic.
Uh-huh.
But you're saying many people don't.
It's conjectured, but in such a vague way that you wouldn't know the right hand side is, in many cases. Mostly.
Yeah, right.
So there's a conjecture equivalence. It's something which you know very little about except classically.
Okay, so I want to actually move on to point out that even in the case of ADS, where I mean we really do know what the right hand side is, there's still a manifestation of this information problem. Which is, sorry, Sean, did you want to say?
I just wanted to ask, don't we actually know examples where we have a precise statement of holography, but it's not a lower dimensional quantum field theory, it's some more complicated object?
It's many lower dimensional.
Sorry.
Oh.
You know. Well, it's a quantum theory that's not a field theory.
Yeah. Okay.
The NS library.
Okay. So, I want to talk about the there's still a manifestation of the problem in the case of ADS-CFT.
Oh, can I interrupt the? So I was led to believe by some distinguished colleague of mine that this you were in earlier instance of time that there was a different argument for this holographic principle, which is to say the entropy of a big region cannot be bigger than the area because you can throw stuff, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. So that's a different holographic principle.
No, it's the same principle. The same principle, but a different argument.
That seems like a clearly formulated statement. Give me a region of space, what's the entropy? Does it scale the volume?
Well, what's space? What's space? Yeah, no, I mean, it's very hard to make it precise.
All that argument, you say to me, yeah. But all that argument, I mean, that argument sounds more precise, but all it does, it sets you a bound. It still doesn't tell you how best to find what would be, in modern language, a dual theory. So, but the nature of the whole thing is that it's a statement that doesn't give you any clues as to how to find the thing you're looking for. But if you're lucky, you find examples like ADS-CFT.
Yeah, I think that's
it.
Is it the only example? This ADS?
The one Shaman mentioned could be tweaked to also give you that kind of thing.
But there are a few similar examples. So, for example, we think that asymptotically Lifshitz spacetimes. Maybe we understand something about the dual, or you know, other things which are very similar to ADS, where there's the time direction is the same on both sides, but so small changes. And then maybe we could argue about matrix theory. Yeah. So there's, we think we understand something about flat space also. In some examples.
So if you compute the entropy with the IDS and do the duality and everything, you find that all the laws are verified, and the all King laws are verified?
Sort of by construction, yeah.
Okay,
it's trivial,
okay.
Yeah, but let me say a little more about the ADS case, which I think may eliminate that. It's not trivial, certainly not.
Okay.
So you should probably also add two-dimensional theory.
Right, so there are some very exotic two-dimensional string solutions, so solutions where the string's propagating in two dimensions, which are not without rotation invariance, without Lorentz invariance, which we can describe in terms of matrix quantum mechanics and theories.
And in every case, in every example you have, all the laws are verified.
Well, I guess in that example, it's a little hard to say what you might mean by those laws.
They're verified as some of the dynamics is verified.
Yeah.
You know. Right. So what I mean by it's true by construction. It's just that you describe the system in terms of an ordinary quantum system. Then that ordinary quantum system will satisfy the laws of thermodynamics to the extent that we can actually show that.
Okay.
Yeah. Right. So there's always the problem that if the system interacts enough to, you know, thermalize, then we can't understand it. So in ADS, which, as I said, the problem is solved by unitarity of the QFT, of the CFT, but there's still a version of it in the following sense. So a large black hole in ADS, describes thermal equilibrium, as you might have expected, of the dual CFT. And I guess maybe I should have said this before then. So gravity in ADS is dual to a CFT in one lower dimension, where, for argument, let's think about the case where the action for gravity in ADS is something like this. So there's some Einstein-Hilbert term. Integral over d plus 1 dimensions, square root of g, there's an Einstein-Hilbert term, and then there's a cosmological constant. I think I probably got the sign wrong. Where I'm going to write that cosmological constant as minus some number over a link. So this is just an initial analysis. There's some link scale appearing here, which determines the size of the ADS geometry. And that link scale and the Newton constant combine to determine some number. So this is dimensionless, you can convince yourself. Some number that I'll call n squared, which this kind of holographic argument that the number of degrees of freedom of the gravity theory in some region should be related to the area of the boundary, tell us that this thing is the number of degrees of freedom per point of the CFT. So in the case where this is a 1 plus 1 dimensional CFT, this is the central charge. And I called it n squared to make contact with examples where it's a gauge theory. So n is the number of colors. And the black hole is of the form that I wrote down before, but where the unblackening factor takes the form r over l ADS squared plus 1. If it were just this, this would be ADS. And then there's an extra term, which is something like R naught over R to the D minus 2, which has a horizon somewhere determined by R naught. And the temperature is some order one number times R naught. And the energy per volume of the dual CFT is the mass density of the black hole is N squared times T to the D. And the entropy per volume, this is the area density of the black hole, is n squared times t to the d minus 1. So the scaling of temperature is just a consequence of conformal variance, and just dimensional analysis and conformal variance. The fact that there's an n squared here is a funny fact about the theory, which I'll come back to. So here's the manifestation of the problem. The manifestation of the problem is that if you consider correlation functions of fields in the space-time, so something like, so imagine phi as some scalar field propagating in this background. I could add some kinetic terms for it here. And just think about this, the two-point function. for the scalar field propagating in this black hole background. This thing, by the way, is related by the ADS-CFT correspondence. If I take the points at which I'm inserting the field to the boundary, which is the asymptotium, this approaches up to factors the correlation function of some local operator in the conformal field theory at finite temperature. So that's this statement. So the black hole and its mass and area and all these things describe the thermodynamic properties of the CFT, and we can study small fluctuations around that thermodynamic equilibrium, you know, inserting local operators in the CFT by studying fluctuations of fields in the space time. And the return of the information problem is that this correlation function decays. It decays in time with some rate that's determined by the temperature. It had to be because that's the only scale in the problem. As t goes to infinity. And so this is to say that the information about this inserting this O is perturbing the equilibrium state in some way that we can keep track of, right? This operator has some labels on it. And if we wait long enough before we measure the response of the system, we just lose that information. This goes to zero. And so again, in a sort of different way, the information about the information, the black hole is eating the information.
You might have explained this to me before. So this in ADS, the black hole does not evaporate.
Ah, yeah, good. I should have said that. Right. So unlike in flat space, where a black hole has negative specific heat and loses its energy to radiation far away, ADS is like a box, and this large black hole in ADS can be in equilibrium with its radiation. Right, good. And so this is this had to be true in order for the statement to be true, right? Because obviously a CFT can have positive specific heat in order for this to be true. Yeah. Okay, and so notice that this statement here is in sharp contradistinction to what you would get if you were instead studying a system with a finite number of degrees of freedom. Where this green function, let me call this g of t, is something of the form 1 over z trace over the CFT Hilbert space e to the minus theta h O of t O of 0. We can write this as a sum over energy eigenstates e to the minus theta ei. We can insert a complete set of energy eigenstates here. What else do I need? E to the I minus ej, and then I've got the sine of t times some number, times some oij squared. And so if there's a finite number of degrees of freedom, this the time dependence of this function is just a sum of Fourier harmonics with a finite number of harmonics. So if there's a finite number of degrees of freedom, this is a quasi-periodic function. Which means that whatever value you pick for it, if you wait long enough, it'll take that value again. And so it can't possibly do this.
So, John, I have a completely stupid question. I just don't get how you can get conformal invariance if you have a space which is that curve. Don't you have a z different from 1? Don't you break the Lorentz invariance with your matrix?
So Lorentz invariance is definitely broken by the black hole.
Yeah.
But that's the statement that putting a CFT at finite temperature will break Lorentz invariance. But the fact that I guess I should also say I also broke conformal invariance by the metric I chose here was of the following form.
And
I put a sphere here. The fact that I put a sphere here means that I'm actually describing a CFT on a sphere. And so the radius of the sphere also breaks conformal invariance. But I can consider a limit, which is called it's called zooming in on some point in the sphere where this thing approaches approaches something that looks like here. Let's also take t goes to zero, so I can write ADS in the I guess I want to move the R square here. And so you can see a copy of the Minkowski line element just sitting in there. So it certainly can preserve events and variance. And the fact that scale invariance is preserved is the fact that if I rescale time and space with z equals 1, then I can absorb that by rescaling r, and then the rescaling of r goes away here.
So the fact that it's solvable is really due to the conformal invariance?
No. So this is, conformal invariance is a convenience. Which, I mean, you see we've already broken it by turning out a finite temperature. Okay. But thank you for asking this because it reminded me that I was talking about CFT on a sphere, and it's important that I'm on a sphere in order to have a finite number of degrees of freedom. I need an infrared cutoff. This can never be of this form, and so that's the puzzle. Notice also that one consequence of this is that if we average it over time, over say some small, I don't know what should I call this, over some time intervals, minus tau to tau, and t, and let's average the norm, say, then I claim that this thing at late times, at t much bigger than the energy spacings, should approach e to the minus the entropy of the system. And so this is, so one consequence of it being a quasi-periodic function is the fact that it can never actually go to zero. Its time averages has to approach something, which is, which is bounded, can't be smaller than this number determined by this number of degrees of freedom. And so I said that the entropy of this black hole went like this, and so this, so here this is something in order e to the minus n squared in this, and n squared times the volume. Okay. The point of this is that this actual answer is actually an n squared here. The actual answer for the correlation function computed here is n squared times e to the minus gamma t. So this is something which this classical calculation of setting a field on this black hole background plus the corrections in powers of 1 over n times something of order e to the minus n squared times some function that does not decay. So from the point of view of the gravity field, an effect of the small, which reproduces these Poincaré occurrences that we expect, is a non-perturbative quantum gravity effect. There's a pretty good idea of where something like this comes from, because this black hole solution that I described here is one solution of the equations of motion with these given boundary conditions, which you should think of that as it's a saddle point of the bulk path integral. So we're computing, say, the partitions. We can compute this Green's function by some path integral over the gravity degrees of freedom. Let's think about the Euclidean case, I guess. Let's think about the Euclidean calculation with some action for the gravity fields. And this thing we're doing with this metric is, one second, is a saddle point approximation to this answer. And if there are other saddle points, so really there's a sum over saddle points. If there are other saddle points, they contribute something of order whatever their action is, and whatever their contribution is. And there is another, which I'll say in a second. Yes, just.
So your expression for G there?
Yeah.
You've superimposed the exponential decay at the oscillation.
Yeah.
So is that for a system with a finite number of degrees of freedom or n number of degrees of freedom?
Right, so let's take n finite I've written here, this is what we get in the expansion in powers of 1 over n, right? So perturbatively in n, we each of the terms decays, and I'm just saying you have to do something non-perturbative in 1 over n to see this effect. And that agrees with this amplitude.
So you're expanding around the limit where the number of degrees of freedom.
That's right. And it's the fact that expansion is asymptotic that's causing the trouble. Okay, and so I just wanted to quickly mention that there is another sound point, which is called thermal ADS, where in fact the spectral density is discrete, and which does contribute an oscillating piece, and where the difference of actions, you know, it comes from something like integral of, you know, one over, it comes from this Einstein action, and so it's natural that it's of order L ADS to the B minus 1 over G Newton, which, as I said, is N squared. And so just the fact that it's a difference of classical actions makes it simple to believe that this other thing will contribute something of order E to the minus N squared. But actually,
so why are you focusing on this? I just want to make sure I understand. So the fact that there's a non-perturbative effect to see the discreteness of the energy levels in the field theory, is that?
Yes.
And so that's important conceptually, I guess, is it? I mean, is that, that's...
Right, it means, the fact that you need to do something non-perturbative, just, it makes it hard, is all I mean.
Why does one necessarily, you know, need to know about the discreteness of the spectrum?
Well, because the discreteness of the spectrum is what will restore the quasi-periodic nature of the function.
It's basically the late time limit and the large n limit don't come in. And so if you want to know what happens at the latest times, you necessarily have to...
What about the thermodynamic limit? I guess it's...
So in these gravity theories that I'm talking... The theories of the gravity dual that I'm talking about, there are really two kinds of thermodynamic limits. So you'll notice that I've written the factor of n squared and the volume here.
Yeah.
And so the number of degrees of freedom is going to infinity in two ways. Mm-hmm. One is which we can take the volume of. The other is that this number of degrees of freedom per point can go to infinity. And so that's the source.
When you take the volume to infinity, the spectrum is not discrete anymore. So.
Yes, that's also true. So you can take everything I've said to be done at a finite volume. And yet, it still isn't the thermodynamic limit. Yeah, that's
in the sense that you have an infinite number of degrees of freedom, but that's unphysical.
Okay, I guess that you can summarize everything I've said now. I agree with you. And so I'm trying to express to you that the thing we're fighting is that holographic theories are unphysical in this sense, that we're expanding around this unphysical point, but it's, you know,
but you see, on the other side, you know, the unphysical point is classical gravity.
But John, I guess it's the version of about
classical gravity.
Mm-hmm.
And the version you point to, the field theory would be infinite volume, right?
Well, I was studying finite volume just to sharpen this point, right? Yeah. Okay. So maybe. Okay, let me make what's the best thing to do here?
John, how much do you...
Yeah, that's what I was just trying to figure out.
Possibly great, but even if you want to come back to the or you want to
Yeah,
I'm enjoying it.
Thank you.
Well, cookies are in 4 minutes, right? let me make one final comment on this subject, and then we can take a break. I didn't get to the part about holographic fermions, not fermi liquids.
You do it 4 minutes, go on.
This last one I think is also more important to make, which is that holographic field theories are weird. So I mean, we've already established them, which they're weird, but I can sharpen this. So having a classical gravity dual requires this number of degrees of freedom per point large. But on the other hand, having a simple classical gravity dual, by which I mean only a few fields in the bulk with small masses, which is the kind of situation that is most useful for this business of trying to construct holographic states of matter. This means that there are only few operators of low dimension in the CFT. That means low dimension means parametrically small, or parametrically order one in all of the control parameters, and these whose correlation functions factorize, meaning they're Gaussian, and they create the excitations which are classical. And these facts combine to mean that the spectrum of such a CFT on, say, a sphere looks something like this. So this is energy. Here's zero. Suppose the radius is r. So the fact that there's only a few operators of low dimension means that there's some power of states here where the spacing is of order 1 over r, so some small number over r. But then eventually you get to a point where at energies of order n squared over r, there are very many more of them. And what I mean by very many more of them is that at these energies, the density of states as a function of energy is of the form e to the plus some function of n squared, where this mu is some proxy for the energy, if the energy is of order n squared of this form, I guess I could set this in here, where so mu is the coefficient of n squared, and the thing that goes here is some function of mu times n squared. So the density of states is exponentially growing in n squared, and you should think of this as the number of ways to make a state with energy of order n squared with n squared oscillators. Imagine n squared harmonic oscillators, each of which has a frequency of order 1. So you think about the combinatorics of that for a minute, and you'll see that you can make exponentially things. And this is exponentially many things. And this is a picture of the free gauge theory. And these facts combine to mean that at temperatures of order 1, so like what we were just describing, so T in this black hole is just determined by this R0, which has nothing to do with N. So by order 1, I mean independent of N. We get an energy which is of order N squared. And so this is a very weird property of the theory that the excitations that are excited in black hole, the things that the black hole is averaging over, are not the things that we can create using these few operators. And this is the reason that the theory can blithely coarse grain over these different states. It's because the differences between these states that the black hole is averaging over are not accessible to these low energy degrees of freedom. And so these are the states that the black hole is coarse graining over, and that's where the dissipation comes from. Okay, so I'm going to stop here. Maybe I'll keep going after some cookies, and whoever wants to come can come. Okay. Let's take a break.
Okay.